For the next several days, there was no sign of Benjamin. I was not locked up, but as a practical matter, this meant that I was confined to the safe house during daylight hours. There was nowhere to go at night. Like any other prisoner, I invented ways to pass the empty hours. Solitude and time-wasting did not bother me. I was used to them. Both were occupational hazards. I was concerned by the lack of exercise, because I did not want to run out of breath in case I had to make a run for it. This seemed a likely outcome. How else could this situation end? I jogged in place for an hour every morning and in the afternoon ran the 100 and the 220-yard dashes. Also in place, but flat out. I did push-ups and sit-ups and side-straddle hops. I punched and karate-chopped the sofa cushions until I had beaten every last mote of dust from them. I jitterbugged in my socks to cracked 78 RPM records I found in a closet, Louis Armstrong, the Harmonica Rascals, the Andrews Sisters, Satchmo's Muskrat Ramble, and the Sisters' Boogie-Woogie Bugle Boy of Company B provided the best workouts. The sergeant stopped by every day to cook lunch and dinner and wash up afterward. He brought quality groceries, and he was a good cook, specializing in curries and local piri-piri dishes loaded with cayenne pepper that made the heart beat in the skull. I asked him to bring me books. He refused money to pay for them or the groceries. Apparently, I was covered by a budget in secret funds, and came back from the African market the next day with at least one Penguin paperback by every writer I had named, and a few more besides. The books were dog-eared and food and coffee-stained, and most were missing pages. I was in bed reading a W. Somerset Maugham short story about adulterers in Malaya when Benjamin finally showed up. As usual, he chose the wee hours of the morning for his visit. He was as stealthy as he had been when he visited me in the hotel, and I heard no car or any other sound of his approach. All the same, I felt his presence before he materialized out of the darkness. He seemed to be alone. He carried a battered leather valise, the kind that has a hinged top that opens like a mouth when the catch is released. The valise seemed to jump in his hand as if it contained a disembodied muscle. I rationalized this by thinking that he must be trembling for some reason. Maybe he had had a bout of fever and was not quite recovered. That would explain why I hadn't seen him for a week. Then, at the instant when I realized that there was something alive inside the valise and it was trying to get out, Benjamin held the bag upside down over my bed and pressed the catch. The bag popped open and a huge blue-black mamba uncoiled itself from within. It landed on my legs. With blinding speed, it coiled and struck. I felt the blow, a soft punch but no sting on my chest just above the heart. I knew that I was a dead man. So, apparently, did the mamba. It stared into my eyes, waiting, or so I thought, for my heart to stop, for the power of thought to switch off. No more than a second had passed. Already I felt cold. An ineffable calm settled upon me. The laboring air conditioner in the window was suddenly almost silent. My hearing seemed to be going first. Next, I thought, my eyes. I felt no pain. I thought, maybe after all there is a God, or was a God, if the last moment of life has been arranged in such a kindly and loving way. Dreamily I watched as Benjamin's hand, black as the mamba, seized the snake behind the head. The serpent struggled, lashing its body and winding itself around Benjamin's arm. The sergeant appeared, stepping out of the darkness and into the light of my reading lamp just as Benjamin had done. It took the combined strength of these two powerful men to stuff the thing back into the valise and close it. They did so without the slightest sign of fear. In the half-light, with their faces close together, they looked more than ever like brothers. How strange it was, I thought, that this surreal scene in this misbegotten place should be the last thing I would ever see. Benjamin handed the valise to the sergeant. It jumped violently in his hand. The sergeant produced a key and, with a perfectly steady hand, locked the valise. His eyes were fixed on me. He was grinning in what I can only describe as total delight. Make that unholy delight. To me, an unsmiling Benjamin said, "You must be wondering why you are not dead yet." He was not grinning. The sergeant, watching me over Benjamin's shoulder, did it for him, big white teeth reflecting more light than there seemed to be in the room. Up to this point I had not looked at my fatal wound. In fact, I had not moved at all since the snake had struck me. Something told me that any movement might quicken the action of the venom and rob me of whatever split seconds of life I might have left. Besides, I did not want to see the wound that I imagined, twin punctures made by the mamba's fangs, perhaps a drop or two of blood, and most horribly, venom oozing from the holes in my skin. Finally, I found the courage to glance at my chest. It was unmarked. I leaped out of bed, dashed into the bathroom, and examined my sweating torso. I stripped off my boxer shorts, the only garment I was wearing, and twisted and turned in the stingy light, looking for what I still feared was a mortal wound. But I saw no break in my skin, no bruise, even. The symptoms of death I had been feeling, the lightheadedness, the shortness of breath, and a sense of loss so intense that it felt like the shutdown of the heart, went away. Without bothering to put my shorts back on, I went back into the bedroom.
"Look at him,"
the sergeant chortled, pointing a finger at me. At first I thought he was making fun of my nakedness. I had spent time on a beach in South Africa, and the part of me formerly covered by my shorts was dead white. I soon realized that he was laughing at something other than my tan line. I was the victim of the most sadistic practical joke since Harry Flashman was kicked out of rugby college. And these two were the jokers. There is no mirth like African mirth, and both Benjamin and the sergeant were doubled over by it. They howled with laughter, their eyes were filled with tears, they gasped for breath, they hugged each other as they danced a jig of merriment. They lost their balance and staggered to regain it.
"Look at him," they said over and over again. "Look at him."
The locked valise had been placed on the bed. The contortions of the infuriated 6-foot-long muscle that was trying to escape from it caused it to skitter across the sheets. I tried to get around the helpless men, but they kept lurching into my path, so I was not able to reach the Webley, Benjamin's gift to me that was stashed under the mattress. My plan was to empty the revolver, if I could get my hands on it, into the pulsating valise. I was in no way certain that I could stick to this plan if I actually had the gun in my hands and this comedy team at point-blank range. Breath by breath, I got hold of myself. So did Benjamin and the sergeant, though it took them a little longer. It was obvious what had happened. Some juju man had captured the snake and removed its fangs and venom sac. Knowing Benjamin, and by now I felt that I knew him intimately despite the brevity of our friendship, he had commissioned the capture and the veterinary surgery. Knowing also how terrified President Ga was of snakes, I could only surmise that the defanged mamba was going to be a player in the overthrow of the tyrant. Maybe if the coup succeeded, Benjamin would make the mamba part of the flag, as an earlier group of patriots had done a couple hundred years ago with another poisonous snake in another British colony. Benjamin offered no explanations for the prank. I was damned if I was going to ask him any questions. I was by no means certain that I could control my voice. By now the joke had cooled off. Benjamin had stopped, smiling. His grave dignity had returned. He made a minimal gesture. The sergeant picked up the valise. Benjamin said,
"I will be back soon."
With a scratchy throat, I said,
"Good."
The two of them let themselves out the front door. I locked it behind them, and as I tried to put the key into my pants pocket, I remembered that I was stark naked. Nakedness was deeply offensive to Christianized Africans like Benjamin. Maybe that was why he had stopped laughing before the joke had really worn off. I reached under the mattress and pulled out the Webley and cocked it. It was a very heavy weapon, weighing almost 3 pounds when fully loaded, and when I felt its heft in my hand, I began to tremble. I could not stop. I was afraid that the gun might go off, but I had so little control over my muscles that I could not safely pull it down. Teeth chattering, my body chilling in a room in which the temperature was not less than 90 degrees, I understood fully and for the first time just what a brilliant son of a bitch Benjamin was. 2 days later, at 5 in the morning, he showed up at the safe house for breakfast. He said he had been up all night. There was no outward sign of this. He was fresh from the shower, his starched uniform still smelled of the iron, and he sat up straight as a cadet in his chair. but he was not his usual masked self. There was an air of excitement about him that he did not bother to conceal. He ate the yolks of his fried eggs with a spoon, then touched the corners of his mouth with his napkin.
"The President of the Republic is very upset," he said.
He spoke in a low tone. It was difficult to hear him because a Benny Goodman record was playing on the phonograph, the usual precaution against eavesdroppers, and Harry James and the rest of the trumpet section were playing as if their four or five horns were a single instrument. I said, "Upset? Why?"
"He has discovered the fangs and the poison sac of a black mamba on his desk."
"Goodness," I said, "no wonder he's upset."
"Yes, he found these things when he came back from one of his women last night. They were right in the center of the blotter in his coffee cup. If someone had poured coffee into the cup, he might well have drunk it absent-mindedly. He said so himself."
I could think of nothing to say. Certainly Benjamin needed no encouragement to go on with his story. He said,
"He flew off the handle and called me immediately. He screamed into the telephone. He was surrounded by traitors," he said. "How could anyone have gained access to his office in his absence, let alone smuggled in the coffee cup? How could no one have noticed this coffee cup and what was in it? There are soldiers everywhere in the presidential palace. Or were."
"They are no longer there?"
"Naturally, he has dismissed them. How could he trust them after this? He also ordered the arrest of the Army Chief of Staff. His order has, of course, been carried out."
"The Army Chief of Staff is in your custody?"
"For the time being, yes. It gives us an opportunity to talk frankly to each other."
"Who is handling security if not the Army?"
"The National Police. This is an honor, but it is a strain on our manpower, especially with the Pan-African Festival beginning the day after tomorrow. Thousands will flood into Nadala, including 26 heads of state and who knows how many other dignitaries and nobodies. But of course, the safety of our own head of state and government is the number one priority."
"You are investigating, of course."
"Oh yes," Benjamin said. "Suspects, some of them of very high rank, are being interviewed. Quarters are being searched. Every safe in the nation is being opened. Information is being gathered. Fingerprints and other physical evidence have been assembled. All the usual police procedures are in place, but on a much larger and more urgent scale than usual. The presidential palace is off limits to everyone except the president and the police."
He was in complete control of his voice and his facial muscles, but underneath his unflappable behavior he glowed with joy. He was within reach of something that he wanted very much indeed.
"The fangs and so on are not at all what we have to worry about," Benjamin went on. "The President for Life has also received an anonymous letter, mysteriously placed under his pillow by an unknown hand, stating that a sample of his bodily secretions has been given to a famous juju man in the Ivory Coast."
This was momentous news. Playing the naif, my assigned role in this charade, I said, "Bodily secretions?"
"We believe they were obtained from one of Gar's women. He is deeply concerned. This can only mean that a curse has been put upon him by an enemy. The curse can be reversed only if we can find the culprit who hired the juju man."
Imparting this news, he remained impassive. No smile, no equivalent of a wink, no expression of any kind came to the surface. Benjamin himself had, of course, engineered everything he was reporting to me, the fangs, the venom, the anonymous letter with its chilling message. But he described these things as if he had no more idea than the man in the moon who was responsible for tormenting President Ga. The juju curse was the keystone of the plot. I had known Africans, one of them an agent of mine who possessed a first-class degree from Cambridge, who had withered and died from witchcraft. The bodily secretion was the vital element in casting a juju spell. Some product of the victim's body was needed to invoke a truly effective curse, a lock of hair, an ounce of urine, a teaspoon of saliva, feces. The more intimate the product, the greater its power. Nothing could be a more effective charm than a man's semen. No wonder Ga was beside himself, and no wonder that he was now in Benjamin's power. By now, more than 30 African heads of state had flown into Ndallah for President Ga's Pan-African conference. This was the day on which they would all ride through the city in their Rolls-Royces and Mercedes-Benzes and Cadillacs, waving to the vast crowd that had been assembled to greet them. Whether any of these spectators had the faintest idea who the dignitaries were or what they were doing in Ndallah were separate questions. Whole tribes had been bussed or trucked or herded on foot into the city from the interior. Many were dancing. Chiefs had brought warriors armed with shields and spears to protect them against enemies, wives to service them, dwarves to keep them entertained. Every single one of these human beings seemed to be grunting or shouting or singing or mostly laughing, and the noise produced by all those voices added to the beating of drums and the sound of musical instruments and the tootling of automobile horns made the air tremble. Palm wine and warm beer flowed, and the spicy aroma of stews and roasting goats rose from hundreds of cook fires. At last the sergeant found the exact spot he had been looking for, an empty space in front of the Parliament building, and parked the car in the shadow of a huge baobab tree. A couple of constables were already on hand, and they cleared away the crowd so that we had an unobstructed view.
"They will come soon," the sergeant said.
It was a little before 5 in the afternoon. The parade was already about 90 minutes behind schedule, but there was no such concept as on time in Ndallah or any other place in Africa. Maybe 40 minutes later, we heard the faraway, warped sound of a brass band playing the British Grenadiers. The music grew louder, and the band marched by, drum major brandishing a baton that was as tall as he was, every musician's eye seemingly fixed on the Austin as the marching men turned eyes left on the Parliament and the flags of the African nations that flew from its circle of flagpoles. A battalion of infantry then marched smartly by, drenched in sweat, arms swinging, boots kicking up powdery dust. The infantry were followed by several tanks and armored cars and howitzers. Finally came a platoon of bagpipers, tartan kilts and sporrans swinging, Scotland the Brave splitting the sun-scorched air. If the Brits had taught these people nothing else in a century of colonialism, they had taught them how to organize a parade.
"Now come the presidents," the sergeant said. "President for life Ga will be first, then the others."
Then, even though we were alone in the car with the windows rolled up, he dropped his voice to a whisper and added,
"Watch very carefully the road ahead of his car."
Ga's regal, snow-white Rolls-Royce materialized out of the dust. There were a few grunts from onlookers, but no ululations or other such behavior. The masses merely watched this strange alien phenomenon, and no doubt they would have reacted in the same way if a spaceship had been landing among them. Not that the occasion was wholly lacking in ceremony. The soldiers posted along the street at 10-foot intervals came to present arms. The sergeant leaped out of the car, and he and the two constables stood to attention, saluting. I got out, too. No one paid the slightest attention to me. But then only a few of the onlookers were paying very much attention to President Ga. The Rolls-Royce continued its stately approach, flags flying, headlights blazing. The crowd stirred and muttered. Then, without warning, the crowd suddenly broke and began to run in all directions. Men, women, children, the decrepit old, borne aloft by their sons and daughters, everyone except the dancers, who had by now fallen into a collective trance and went right on dancing, oblivious to the panic all around them. Everyone else scattered as fast as their legs would carry them. The presidential Rolls-Royce slammed on its brakes and stood on its nose. Inside it, President Ga, or one of his doubles, dressed in a white uniform, was thrown about like a rag doll. It was impossible not to see Benjamin's hand in all this. A single thought filled my mind. Assassination. He was going to kill this man in full view of 30 other presidents for life. I leaped onto the hood of the Austin, then scrambled to the roof. From that vantage point, I saw what all the fright was about. A black mamba at least 10 feet long was slithering with almost unbelievable swiftness across the road in the path of the white Rolls-Royce. Suddenly, half a dozen brave fellows, half-naked all of them, leaped out of the crowd and attacked the serpent with pangas, cutting it into pieces that writhed violently as if trying to reconnect themselves into a living reptile. The crowd uttered a loud, collective basso grunt. This was a huge yet subdued sound, like a whisper amplified to the power of 10,000 on some enormous hi-fi speaker yet to be invented. The Rolls-Royce, klaxon sounding, sped away. The sergeant said,
"Get into the car. We must go."
I did as he ordered. Inside the sweltering, buttoned-up Austin, I asked if the Mamba crossing President Ga's path on his day of triumph would be seen as a bad omen.
"Oh, yes,"
the sergeant said, grinning into the mirror.
"Very bad. No one who saw will ever forget."
Darkness fell. The sergeant did not take me home, but drove me to a different safe house on the outskirts of the city. As soon as we were inside, I switched on the English-language radio. The opening ceremonies of the Pan-African Conference were now in progress at the soccer stadium. Announcers shouted to be heard above the blare of bands and choirs, the boom of fireworks, and the noise of the crowd. Needless to say, not a word was uttered over the airways about the meeting between the Mamba and Ga's white Rolls-Royce. Everyone knew all about it anyway by word of mouth or talking drum or one of the many Bantu tongues that could be signed or whistled as well as spoken. In all those minds, as in my own, the questions were, what happens next, and when will it happen? I left the radio on, knowing that the first word of the coup would come from its speakers. Second only to the capture or murder of the prince, the broadcasting station was the most important objective in any coup d'état. Obviously, Benjamin and his co-conspirators, assuming that he had any, must strike tonight. Never again would he have such an opportunity to destroy the tyrant before the very eyes of Africa. He would want to kill Ga in the most humiliating way possible. He would want to show him as weak, impotent, and alone, without a single person willing or able to defend him. Promptly at 8 o'clock, the sergeant carried a cooler into the house, rattled pots and pans in the kitchen, and served my dinner, all 5 courses at once. The food was French.
"This is the same food that all the presidents will be eating at the state dinner,"
the sergeant said. I ate only the heated-up entree, medallions of veal and a cream sauce that had separated because the sergeant had let it boil. Around 2 in the morning, the sergeant's walkie-talkie squawked. He lifted it to his ear, heard what sounded to me like a single word, and replied with what also seemed to be a single word. The conversation lasted less than a second. He said,
"Come, Mr. Brown, it is time to go."
We drove through a maze of streets, but on this night of revelry saw no sleepers by the wayside. Everybody was still celebrating. Oil lamps and candles glowed in the blackness like red and yellow eyes, as if the entire genus Carnivora was drawn up in a hungry circle on the outskirts of the party. Music blared from loudspeakers, people danced, thousands of shouted conversations stirred the stagnant, overheated air. The city had become one enormous, throbbing equator club. The sergeant maneuvered the Austin through the pandemonium with one hand on the steering wheel and the other on the hooter, constantly beeping to let people know that he wasn't trying to sneak up on them and kill them. Not since Independence Night, I thought, could there have been so many witnesses awake at this hour, ready to observe whatever Benjamin was going to do next. At last we drove out of the crowd and into the European quarter. Through the rear window I could see the distorted, smoky red glow of the city. I imagined I could feel the earth quivering in rhythm to the innumerable bare feet that were pounding it in unison a mile or so away. The music and the shouting were very loud even at such a distance. The sergeant drove at his usual brisk pace, lights off as usual. He parked the car and switched off the engine. By now my eyes had adjusted, and I could see another police car parked a few yards away. We were parked on a low hilltop, and the red glow of the city caught in the mirror shine of its metal. Soon a third car drove up and parked close beside us. It was Benjamin's Rover, identifiable by the baritone throb of its engine. The driver's cap badge caught a little light. A large man who might have been Benjamin sat in the back seat alone. Moving swiftly, Benjamin got into the back seat with me. The dome light blinked. He wore the dress uniform I supposed he had worn to the state dinner, long pants, white shirt with necktie, short, epauletted mess jacket that the Brits call a bum freezer. Decorations. Benjamin smelled, as usual, of starch, brass polish, soap, his own musk. Headlights swept up the hill, turned sharp left into the street that paralleled the one on which our own cars were parked, then stopped. Car doors slammed, men moved quick time, a key turned in a lock. A door squeaked as it was opened. A scratchy Edith Piaf LP played 5 or 6 bars of Les Amants du Paris. We were parked behind the house into which Ga had gone to keep his rendezvous for tonight. Jumpy light showed in an upstairs window, dim and yellowish, as if filtering down a hallway from another room. The back door opened. A flashlight blinked. The rover's headlights flashed in reply.
Come,
Benjamin said. He got out of the car and strode into the darkness. I followed. The sergeant got something out of the trunk, then slammed the lid. Behind me, I heard his brogans at a run. We went through the open door. Inside the house, the record changed on the hi-fi and Piaf began to sing Il Pleut. Benjamin, entirely at home, strode down a hallway, then up a stairway. At the top, in half-shadow outside a half-open bedroom door, a policeman stood at attention as if he did not quite know exactly what was expected of him or what would happen next. In a mirror, I saw a man and a woman engaged in vigorous coitus and heard the woman's moans and outcries. The sergeant marched into the room. Benjamin gave me a little push and I marched in behind him. The room was full of burning candles. The smell of incense was strong. Smoke hung in the air. The woman shouted something in what sounded to me like Swedish. She was quite small. President Ga, lying on top of her, covered her completely. Her legs were wound around his waist, ankles crossed, feet in gilt shoes with stiletto heels. I looked into the mirror in hope of seeing the girl's face. My eyes met Ga's. The candlelight exaggerated the size of his startled, wide-open eyes. His face twisted into a mask of furious anger, and he rolled off the woman, knocking off one of her shoes. Now I saw her face, smeared with lipstick and tousled hair. She was a cookie-cutter blonde, as flawless as a dummy in a store window. I knew what was coming next, of course. The sergeant took one step forward. In his outstretched hands, he held the valise that I remembered so well. Evidently, that was what he had retrieved from the trunk of the Austin. The snap of brass latches sounded like the metallic 1-2 of the slide of an automatic pistol. The sergeant opened the valise and turned it upside down. The Mamba flowed out of the bag with the same unbelievable swiftness, as if it were coming into being before our eyes. I tried to leap backward, but Benjamin stood immediately behind me, blocking the way. President Ga and the blonde froze as if captured in a black-and-white photograph by the flash of a strobe light. The snake, a blur as it attacked, struck at the nearest target, President Ga. He grunted as if a bullet had entered his body. His mouth opened wide and he shouted in English,
"Oh Jesus, sweet Jesus!"
It was a prayer, not a blasphemy. In the same breath, he uttered a tremendous sob. Between these two primal sounds, the woman, screaming, threw her body over the foot of the bed. Somehow she landed behind us on all fours in the hallway. Still shrieking, still wearing one gilt shoe, she sprinted down the hallway. The constable in the hall pursued her for a step or two, picked up the shoe after she kicked it off, and caught her by the hair, which was very long. Her head jerked back, but she kept going, leaving the constable with a handful of blonde threads in his hand. He stared at these in puzzlement, then blew his whistle. At the head of the stairs, the woman was captured by a second constable, a man almost as large as Benjamin. He carried her, squirming, kicking, screaming, back toward the bedroom. Her skin was so white that I half expected powder to fly from it. She bit his face. He twisted her jaw until she let go, and when he saw his own blood on her teeth, he slammed her twice against the wall, then let go of her, throwing his hands wide in disgust that a woman should have attacked him, should have bitten him. Her limp, unconscious body slid to the floor. She landed with a thump on her round bottom, her back against the wall, her head lolling inside its curtain of hair. She twitched as if dreaming, and I wondered if her spine was broken. She had shapely breasts, pretty legs, peroxided delta, and it looked as though she had lipsticked her nipples. For some reason, maybe because this touch of perversity was so unimaginative, so innocent, such a learner's trick, my heart went out to her, if only for a moment. Behind me, I heard a gunshot. In the confined space of the bedroom, it sounded like an artillery round going off. The stink of cordite mingled with the incense. Benjamin stood over the bed with a smoking Webley in his hand. The headless snake in its death throes whipped uncontrollably over the bed, spraying blood on Gah and the sheets. With his hands protecting his genitals, Gah scooted rapidly backward over the bed to escape the serpent, even though he must have known that it was now harmless. What a seed God planted in the human mind on the day that Adam ate the apple. From the look on Gah's face, it was clear that he believed that he himself was dying almost as fast as the snake had just done. But his instincts, from which he could not escape, instructed him to cover his nakedness and flee for his life. Gah's eyes were now fixed on Benjamin. The question in them was easy to read. Had Benjamin murdered him? Or rescued him? Benjamin made a gesture to Gah. Come. Gah, strangling on the words, said,
Doctor!
Benjamin ignored him. Silently, he pointed a finger first at the sergeant, then at Gah. Then he whirled on his heel and left the room. The sergeant picked up the writhing snake and threw it into the hallway, then grasped Gah's left arm, turned him onto his stomach, and expertly cuffed his hands behind him. Surprised, then outraged, Gah shouted,
I order you!
The sergeant punched him hard in the kidney. Gah shrieked in pain and subsided, gasping. The sergeant shouted an order in his own language. Two constables, the one who had been posted in the hallway all along, and the one the blonde had bitten, came into the room, pulled Gah to his feet, and marched him naked down the hallway past the headless Mamba, past the crumpled blonde, and out the back door. The Mamba, still twitching, would be the first thing the girl would see when she opened her eyes. In the bedroom, the hi-fi played the last words of the Piaf song that had begun as we entered the house. It had taken Benjamin 3 minutes and 20 seconds to carry out his coup d'etat. Outside, Gah struggled with the two constables who were trying to stuff him into the trunk of Benjamin's Rover. He kicked, squirmed, butted. One of the constables struck him on the hip bone with his baton. Gah collapsed like a marionette whose strings had been cut. The constables heaved him into the trunk and slammed it shut. One of them locked it and then, in his jubilation, knocked on it to make a little joke. The sergeant spoke an angry word to him. Benjamin had already taken his place in the back seat of the Rover. I expected to be put into another car or to be left behind, but the sergeant opened the door for me, and I got in and sat beside Benjamin. We heard Gah in the trunk behind us, groans, childlike sobs, whisperings, appeals to Jesus, an explosive shout of Benjamin's name, so throat-scraping in its loudness that I imagined spit flying from Gah's mouth. If Benjamin derived any satisfaction from these proofs that his enemy was entirely in his power, he did not show it by sign or sound. He sat at attention in his Victorian dress uniform, silent, unmoving, eyes front. The sergeant's Austin, driven by one of the constables, tailgated us as we rolled through the wide-awake city. It was just as noisy as before, but more drunken, more out of control. What must Gah be thinking as he lay in pitch darkness, folded like a fetus, naked and in shackles? 10 minutes ago, he had been the most powerful man in Africa. Not now. He was silent. Why? Did he fear that the crowd would discover him and drag him out of the trunk and parade him naked through the howling mob? Did he imagine photographs and newsreels of this appalling humiliation being seen by the entire world? We arrived at a darkened building I did not recognize. Somewhere above us a red light pulsed, and when I got out of the car I looked upward and realized it was the warning beacon on the tower of the national radio transmitter. I made out the silhouettes of an armored car and maybe a dozen men in uniform. The constables hauled Ga out of the trunk. He struggled and shouted words in a language I did not understand. The door opened and emitted a shaft of light. To my eyes, which had seen nothing brighter than a candle flame all evening, it was blindingly bright. We went through the door, a back entrance, into a cramped stairwell. A young chief inspector came to attention and saluted. He looked and behaved remarkably like the spick-and-span army captain I had met at the presidential palace. Other constables were posted on the stairway, one man on every other step. Incongruously for men who dressed like British bobbies and were trained to behave like them, each was armed with a submachine gun. I wondered what would happen if they all started shooting at once in this concrete chamber. Ga screamed a question.
"Do you know who I am?"
No one answered. In a different, commanding tone, Ga said,
"I am the president of this republic, elected by the people. I have been kidnapped by these criminals. I order you to arrest them at once."
Ga sounded like his newsreel self, voice like a church bell, and in spite of his abject state, looked like that old self, blazing eyes, imperious manner. However, the reality was that two large policemen had hold of his arms. He was naked and in chains, and spattered with the blood of the Mamba. A string of spittle hung from the corner of his mouth. The constables gave him a shove in the direction of the stairs. He stubbed his naked toes on the concrete step and sucked a sharp breath through his clenched teeth. This sound turned into a sob of frustration. The men to whom he was giving orders would not look at him. I wondered if the next event in this Alice in Wonderland scenario might involve sitting Ga down at the microphone and ordering him to tell the nation that he had been removed from power. But no, he was frog-marched up the stairs and into the control room by his escorts. I remained with Benjamin and the sergeant in the studio. The control room was brightly lit. It was strange to gaze through the soundproof glass and see the wild-haired, glaring, unclothed Ga looking like one of his ancestors from the Neolithic. The engineer switched on his mic and said,
"Ready when you are, Chief Constable."
Into the open mic, Ga shouted,
"You will die, all of you! Your families will die! Your tribes, all of you will die!"
The engineer, quaking with fear, switched off the microphone. But Ga's mouth kept moving until the bigger constable put his hand over it, gagging him. Eyes rolling, chest heaving as he fought for breath, he kept on shouting. The constable pinched his nostrils shut, and the dumb show noise behind the soundproof glass ceased. Detecting movement near at hand, I shifted my gaze. A man in night clothes was seated at the microphone. He was at least as nervous as the engineer. Benjamin handed him a sheet of paper. It was covered by Benjamin's perfect penmanship. Benjamin, a man who delegated nothing except, apparently, the most important announcement ever made over Radio Nadala, gave the engineer a thumbs-up signal. The engineer counted off seconds on raised fingers. He pointed to the announcer, who began reading in mellifluous broadcaster's English.
"Pay attention to this message from the High Command of Nadala to all the people of our country," he said, voice steady but head twitching and hands trembling. "The tyrant Akokwu Ga is no longer the president of Nadala. He has been charged with mass murder, with treason, with corruption and with other serious crimes, and will be tried and punished according to the law. The functions of the government have been assumed for the time being by the High Command of the Armed Services and the National Police. The United Nations and the embassies of friendly nations have been informed of these developments. The people are to remain calm, obey the police, and return to their homes at once. An election to select a new head of state will be held in due course. The people are safe. The nation is safe. Investments by foreign nationals are safe. The treasure stolen by Akokwu Ga from the people is being recovered. All guests in our country are safe, and they are at liberty to remain in Nadala or leave Nadala whenever they wish. Additional communiques will be issued from time to time by the High Command. Long live Nadala! Long live independence and freedom! Long live justice! Long live democracy!"
As the announcer read, Ga, listening intently, became very still, very attentive, his gaze fixed on what must have been a loudspeaker inside the control room. He might have been a child listening to a bedtime story about himself. So complete was his absorption in what was being said. His eyes were wide, his face bore a look of wonder, his mouth was slightly open. A police photographer took several pictures of him. Ga drew himself up and posed, head thrown back, one shackled foot advanced, as if he were wearing one of his resplendent uniforms. After that, he was marched back to the rover and again dumped into its trunk. He did not struggle or make a sound. The camera, it seemed, had given him back his dignity. Roadblocks manned by soldiers had been erected on the road to the presidential palace. At the approach of Benjamin's rover, they opened the barricades and saluted as we passed. We were a feeble force, two ordinary sedans, not even flying flags, four police constables, and an American spy with a defective passport, plus the prisoner in the trunk of the car who was the reason for the soldiers' awe. The palace came into view, illuminated as before by the megawatts that flooded down from the light towers. A dozen stretch limousines, seals of high office painted on their doors, were parked in the circular drive of the presidential palace. The palace doors were guarded by police constables armed with Kalashnikovs. On the roof of the palace, more constables manned the machine guns and anti-aircraft guns that they had taken over from the army. Benjamin waited for the constables in charge to haul Ga from the trunk, then he got out of the car. He gave me no instructions, so I followed along as he strode into the palace with his usual lack of ceremony. We climbed the grand stairway. All busts and statues and portraits in oil of Ga in his many uniforms had been removed. Less than an hour before, he had walked down these stairs as President of the Republic for life. Now he climbed them as a prisoner, dragging chains. There was a dreamlike quality to this scene, as if we did not belong in it or deserve it, as if it were a reenactment of an event from the life of some other tyrant who had lived and died in some other hour of history. Did Caesar, as he felt the knife, remember some assassinated Greek who had died a realer death? A courtroom of sorts had been organized in Ga's vast and magnificent office. His desk and all his likenesses had been removed from this room, too. The Nadalan flag remained, flanked by what I took to be the flags of the armed forces and other government entities, but not by the presidential flag. The presidential conference table, vast and gleaming and smelling of wax, stood crosswise where Ga's desk had formerly been. Through the window behind it, Ga's antelopes and gazelles could be seen, bathed in incandescent light as they bounded across the paddocks of his game park. Half a dozen grave men in British-style Army, Navy, and Air Force uniforms sat at the table like members of a court-martial. They were flanked by a half-dozen others in black judicial robes and white wigs, clearly members of the Supreme Court, and a handful of other dignitaries wearing national dress or European suits. All but the military types seemed to be confused by the entrance of the prisoner. In some cases, this was obviously the last thing they had expected to see. Some, if not all of them, probably had not been told why they were there. Maybe some simply did not recognize Ga. Who among them had ever imagined seeing in his present miserable state the invulnerable creature the President of the Republic had been? If, in fact, there were any doubts about his identity, Ga removed them at once. In his unmistakable voice, he shouted,
"As President for life of the Republic, I command you, all you generals, to arrest this man on a charge of high treason."
He attempted to point at Benjamin, but of course could not do so with his wrists chained to his waist. Nevertheless, it was an impressive performance. Ga's voice was thunderous. His eyes flashed. He was the picture of command. For an instant, he seemed to be fully clothed again. He gave every possible indication that he expected to be obeyed without question. But he was not obeyed, and when he continued to shout, the large constable did what he had done before at the radio station. He clapped a hand over Ga's mouth and pinched his nostrils shut, and this time prolonged the treatment until Ga's struggle for breath produced high-pitched gasps that sounded very much like an infant crying. The trial lasted less than an hour. Some might have called it a travesty, but everyone present knew that Gah was guilty of the crimes with which he was charged, and guilty, too, of even more heinous ones. Besides that, they knew that they must kill Gah now that they had witnessed his humiliation, or die themselves if he regained power. The trial itself followed established forms. Benjamin, as head of the National Police, had prepared a bundle of evidence that was presented by a prosecutor and objected to by a lawyer appointed to defend Gah. Both men wore barrister's wigs. Witnesses were duly sworn. They testified to the massacre of the beggars. The immaculate young captain testified that Gah had embezzled not less than $50 million American dollars from the National Treasury and deposited them in secret accounts in Geneva, Zurich, and Liechtenstein. The court heard tape recordings of Gah in secret meetings with foreign ambassadors and businessmen, agreeing to make certain high appointments and award certain contracts in return for certain sums of money. Damning evidence was introduced that Gah had ordered the death of his own brother and had perhaps fed him alive to hyenas in the game park. Without retiring to deliberate, the court returned a unanimous verdict of guilty on all counts. Benjamin, who was not a member of the court-martial, did not join the others at the table and was not called to testify. He spoke not a single word during the proceedings. When Gah, who had also been silent, was asked if he had anything to say before the sentence was pronounced, he laughed. But it was a very small laugh. The prisoner was delivered to Benjamin for immediate execution. After this, the court-martial reconvened as the Council of the High Command, and in Gah's presence, or more accurately, as if Gah no longer existed and had been rendered invisible, elected the Chief of Staff of the Army as acting head of state and government. Benjamin kept his old job, his old title, his old powers, and presumably his pension. I wish I could tell you for the sake of symmetry that Gah died the kind of barbarous death that he had decreed for others, that Benjamin fed him like a Thompson's gazelle to the cheetahs or gashed his flesh and set a pack of hyenas on him under the stadium lights. But nothing of the sort happened. What happened was this. The generals and admirals and justices and the others got into their cars and drove away. Gah, Benjamin, the sergeant, the two constables and I went outside. We walked across the palace grounds, Gah limping in his chains, away from the palace, over the lawns. Animals in the zoo stirred. Something growled as it caught our scent. Only the animals took an interest in what was happening. The constables guarding the palace stayed at their posts. The servants had vanished. Looking back at the palace, I had the feeling that it was completely empty. When we came to a place that was nearly out of sight of the palace, the white mansion glowed like a toy in the distance. We stopped. The constables let go of Gah and stepped away from him. Gah said something to Benjamin in what sounded to me like the same language that Benjamin and the sergeant spoke to each other. Benjamin walked over to Gah and bent his head. Gah whispered something in his ear. Benjamin made a gesture. The sergeant vanished. So did the two constables. I made as if to go. Benjamin said,
"No, stay."
The stadium lights went out. The sun was just below the horizon in the east. I could feel its mass pulling at my bones, and even before it became visible, its heat on my skin. We walked on, until we could no longer see the presidential palace or light of any kind, no matter where we looked. Only moments of darkness remained. Gah sank to his knees, with difficulty because of the chains, and stared at the place where the sun would rise. Briefly, Benjamin placed a hand on his shoulder. Neither man spoke. The rim of the sun appeared on the horizon, and then, with incredible buoyancy and radiance, as if slung from the heavens, the entire star leaped into view. Benjamin stepped back a pace, pointed his Webley at the back of Gah's head, and pulled the trigger. The sound was not loud. Gah's body was thrown forward by the impact of the bullet. Red mist from his wound remained behind, hanging in the air and seemed to shoot from the edge of the sun. But that was a trick of light. Benjamin did not examine the corpse or even look at it. I realized he was going to leave it for the hyenas and the jackals and the vultures and the many other creatures that would find it. Benjamin said to me,
You have seen everything. Tell them in Washington.
All right, I said. But tell me why.
Benjamin said,
You know why, Mr. Brown.
He walked away. I followed him, not sure I could find my way out of this scrubby wilderness without him, but not sure either whether he was going back to civilization or just going back.